The Confidence Man, His Masquerade. Chapter 1. A mute goes aboard a boat on the Mississippi. At sunrise on a 1st of April, there appeared, suddenly as Manco Capac at the Lake Titicaca, a man in cream colors, at the waterside in the city of St. Louis. His cheek was fair, his chin downy, his hair flaxen, his hat a white fur one, with a long fleecy nap. He had neither trunk, valise, carpet bag, nor parcel. No porter followed him. He was unaccompanied by friends. From the shrugged shoulders, titters, whispers, wonderings of the crowd, it was plain that he was, in the extremest sense of the word, a stranger. In the same moment with his advent, he stepped aboard the favorite steamer Fidel, on the point of starting for New Orleans. Stared at, but unsaluted, with the air of one neither courting nor shunning regard, but evenly pursuing the path of duty, lead it through solitudes or cities, he held on his way along the lower deck until he chanced to come to a placard nigh the captain's office, offering a reward for the capture of a mysterious impostor, supposed to have recently arrived from the East, quite an original genius in his vocation, as would appear, though wherein his originality consisted was not clearly given, but what purported to be a careful description of his person followed. As if it had been a theater bill, crowds were gathered about the announcement, and among them certain chevaliers, whose eyes, it was plain, were on the capitals, or, at least, earnestly seeking sight of them from behind intervening coats, but as for their fingers, they were enveloped in some myth, though, during a chance interval, one of these chevaliers somewhat showed his hand in purchasing from another chevalier, ex officio a peddler of money belts, one of his popular safeguards, while another peddler, who was still another versatile chevalier, hawked, in the thick of the throng, the lives of Mezen, the bandit of Ohio, Merle, the pirate of the Mississippi, and the brothers Harp, the thugs of the Green River country, in Kentucky creatures, with others of the sort, one and all exterminated at the time, and for the most part, like the hunted generations of wolves in the same regions, leaving comparatively few successors, which would seem cause for unalloyed gratulation, and is such to all except those who think that in new countries, where the wolves are killed off, the foxes increase. Pausing at this spot, the stranger so far succeeded in threading his way, as at last to plant himself just beside the placard, when, producing a small slate and tracing some words upon it, he held it up before him on a level with the placard, so that they who read the one might read the other. The words were these, dash. Charity thinketh no evil. As, in gaining his place, some little perseverance, not to say persistence, of a mildly inoffensive sort, had been unavoidable, it was not with the best relish that the crowd regarded his apparent intrusion, and upon a more attentive survey, perceiving no badge of authority about him, but rather something quite the contrary, he being of an aspect so singularly innocent, an aspect too, which they took to be somehow inappropriate to the time and place, and inclining to the notion that his writing was of much the same sort, in short, taking him for some strange kind of simpleton, harmless enough, would he keep to himself, but not wholly unobnoxious as an intruder, they made no scruple to jostle him aside, while one, less kind than the rest, or more of a wag, by an unobserved stroke, dexterously flattened down his fleecy hat upon his head. Without readjusting it, the stranger quietly turned, and writing anew upon the slate, again held it up, dash. Charity suffereth long, and is kind. Illy pleased with his pertinacity, as they thought it, the crowd a second time thrust him aside, and not without epithets and some buffets, all of which were unresented. But, as if at last despairing of so difficult an adventure, wherein one, apparently a non-resistant, sought to impose his presence upon fighting characters, the stranger now moved slowly away, yet not before altering his writing to this, dash. Charity endureth all things. Shield-like bearing his slate before him, amid stares and jeers he moved slowly up and down, at his turning points again changing his inscription to Charity believeth all things. And then Charity never faileth. The word charity, as originally traced, remained throughout uneffaced, not unlike the left-hand numeral of a printed date, otherwise left for convenience in blank. To some observers, the singularity, if not lunacy, of the stranger was heightened by his muteness, and, perhaps also, by the contrast to his proceedings afforded in the actions quite in the wonted and sensible order of things of the barber of the boat, whose quarters, under a smoking saloon, and over against a barroom, was next door but two to the captain's office. As if the long, wide, covered deck, hereabouts built up on both sides with shop-like windowed spaces, were some Constantinople arcade or bazaar, where more than one trade is plied, this river barber, aproned and slippered, but rather crusty looking for the moment, it may be from being newly out of bed, was throwing open his premises for the day, and suitably arranging the exterior. With businesslike dispatch, having rattled down his shutters, and at a palm tree angle set out in the iron fixture his little ornamental pole, and this without overmuch tenderness for the elbows and toes of the crowd, he concluded his operations by bidding people stand still more aside, when, jumping on a stool, he hung over his door, on the customary nail, a gaudy sort of illuminated pasteboard sign, skillfully executed by himself, gilt with the likeness of a razor elbowed in readiness to shave, and also, for the public benefit, with two words not unfrequently seen ashore gracing other shops besides barbers, dash. No trust. An inscription which, though in a sense not less intrusive than the contrasted ones of the stranger, did not, as it seemed, provoke any corresponding derision or surprise, much less indignation, and still less, to all appearances, did it gain for the inscriber the repute of being a simpleton. Meanwhile, he with the slate continued moving slowly up and down, not without causing some stares to change into jeers, and some jeers into pushes, and some pushes into punches, when suddenly, in one of his turns, he was hailed from behind by two porters carrying a large trunk, but as the summons, though loud, was without effect, they accidentally or otherwise swung their burden against him, nearly overthrowing him, when, by a quick start, a peculiar inarticulate moan, and a pathetic telegraphing of his fingers, he involuntarily betrayed that he was not alone dumb, but also deaf. Presently, as if not wholly unaffected by his reception thus far, he went forward, seating himself in a retired spot on the forecastle, nigh the foot of a ladder there leading to a deck above, up and down which ladder some of the boatmen, in discharge of their duties, were occasionally going. From his betaking himself to this humble quarter, it was evident that, as a deck passenger, the stranger, simple though he seemed, was not entirely ignorant of his place, though his taking a deck passage might have been partly for convenience, as, from his having no luggage, it was probable that his destination was one of the small wayside landings within a few hours' sail. But, though he might not have a long way to go, yet he seemed already to have come from a very long distance. Though neither soiled nor slovenly, his cream-colored suit had a tossed look, almost lindy, as if, traveling night and day from some far country beyond the prairies, he had long been without the solace of a bed. His aspect was at once gentle and jaded, and, from the moment of seating himself, increasing in tired abstraction and dreaminess. Gradually overtaken by slumber, his flaxen head drooped, his whole lamb-like figure relaxed, and, half reclining against the ladder's foot, lay motionless, as some sugar snow in March, which, softly stealing down overnight, with its white placidity startles the brown farmer peering out from his threshold at daybreak. Chapter 2. Showing that many men have many minds. Odd fish. Poor fellow. Who can he be? Casper Hauser. Bless my soul. Uncommon countenance. Green prophet from Utah. Humbug. Singular innocence. Means something. Spirit rapper. Moon calf. Piteous. Trying to enlist interest. Beware of him. Fast asleep here, and, doubtless, pickpockets on board. Kind of daylight Endymion. Escaped convict, worn out with dodging. Jacob dreaming at Lewes. Such the epitaphic comments, conflictingly spoken or thought, of a miscellaneous company, who, assembled on the overlooking, crosswise balcony at the forward end of the upper deck nearby, had not witnessed preceding occurrences. Meantime, like some enchanted man in his grave, happily oblivious of all gossip, whether chiseled or chatted, the deaf and dumb stranger still tranquilly slept, while now the boat started on her voyage. The great ship canal of Vinkingching, in the Flowery Kingdom, seems the Mississippi in parts, where, amply flowing between low, vine-tangled banks, flat as towpaths, it bears the huge toppling steamers, bedizened and lacquered within like imperial junks. Pierced along its great white bulk with two tiers of small embrasure-like windows, well above the waterline, the Fiddle, though, might a distance have been taken by strangers for some whitewashed fort on a floating isle. Merchants on change seem the passengers that buzz on her decks, while, from quarters unseen, comes a murmur as of bees in the comb. Fine promenades, domed saloons, long galleries, sunny balconies, confidential passages, bridal chambers, staterooms plenty as pigeonholes, and out-of-the-way retreats like secret drawers in an escritoire, present-like facilities for publicity or privacy. Auctioneer or coiner, with equal ease, might somewhere here drive his trade. Though her voyage of 1,200 miles extends from apple to orange, from clime to clime, yet, like any small ferry boat, to right and left, at every landing, The huge Fidel still receives additional passengers in exchange for those that disembark, so that, though always full of strangers, she continually, in some degree, adds to, or replaces them with strangers still more strange, like Rio Janeiro fountain, fed from the Cocovard mountains, which is ever overflowing with strange waters, but never with the same strange particles in every part. Though hitherto, as has been seen, the man in cream colors have by no means passed unobserved, yet by stealing into retirement, and there going asleep and continuing so, he seemed to have courted oblivion, a boon not often withheld from so humble an applicant as he. Those staring crowds on the shore were now left far behind, seen dimly clustering like swallows on eaves, while the passengers' attention was soon drawn away to the rapidly shooting high bluffs and shot towers on the Missouri shore, or the bluff-looking Missourians and towering Kentuckians among the throngs on the decks. By and by, two or three random stoppages having been made, and the last transient memory of the slumberer vanished, and he himself, not unlikely, waked up and landed ere now the crowd, as is usual, began in all parts to break up from a concourse into various clusters or squads, which in some cases disintegrated again into quartets, trios, and couples, or even solitaires, involuntarily submitting to that natural law which ordains dissolution equally to the mass, as in time to the member. As among Chaucer's Canterbury pilgrims, or those Oriental ones crossing the Red Sea towards Mecca in the festival month, there was no lack of variety. Natives of all sorts, and foreigners, men of business and men of pleasure, parlor men and backwoodsmen, farm hunters and fame hunters, heiress hunters, gold hunters, buffalo hunters, bee hunters, happiness hunters, truth hunters, and still keener hunters after all these hunters. Fine ladies in slippers, and moccasin squaws, northern speculators and eastern philosophers, English, Irish, German, Scotch, Danes, Santa Fe traders in striped blankets, and Broadway bucks in cravats of cloth of gold, fine-looking Kentucky boatmen, and Japanese-looking Mississippi cotton planters, Quakers in full drab, and United States soldiers in full regimentals, slaves, black, mulatto, quadroon, modish young Spanish Creoles, and old-fashioned French Jews, Mormons and Papists, Stives and Lazarus, jesters and mourners, teetotalers and convivialists, deacons and blacklegs, hard-shell Baptists and clay-eaters, grinning Negroes, and Sioux chiefs solemn as high priests. In short, a piebald parliament, an anacharsis clutes congress of all kinds of that multiform pilgrim species, man. As pine, beech, birch, ash, hackmatack, hemlock, spruce, basswood, maple, interweave their foliage in the natural wood, so these mortals blended their varieties of visage and garb. A Tartar-like picturesqueness, a sort of pagan abandonment and assurance. Here arraign the dashing and all-fusing spirit of the West, whose type is the Mississippi itself, which, uniting the streams of the most distant and opposite zones, pours them along, helter-skelter, in one cosmopolitan and confident tide. Chapter 3. In which a variety of characters appear. In the forward part of the boat, not the least attractive object, for a time, was a grotesque Negro cripple, in tow-cloth attire and an old coal sifter of a tambourine in his hand, who, owing to something wrong about his legs, was, in effect, cut down to the stature of a Newfoundland dog, his knotted black fleece and good-natured, honest black face rubbing against the upper part of people's thighs as he made shift to shuffle about, making music, such as it was, and raising a smile even from the gravest. It was curious to see him, out of his very deformity, indigence, and houselessness, so cheerily endured, raising mirth in some of that crowd, whose own purses, hearths, hearts, all their possessions, sound limbs included, could not make gay. "What is your name, old boy?" said a purple-faced drover, putting his large purple hand on the cripple's bushy wool, as if it were the curled forehead of a black steer. "Der Black Guinea Day calls me, Sar."
"And who is your master, Guinea?"
"Oh Sar, I am Der Dog Without Massa."
"A free dog, eh? Well, on your account, I'm sorry for that, Guinea. Dogs without masters fare hard."
"So they do, Sar, so they do. But you see, Sar, does they hear legs? What G.E. men want to own does they hear legs?
But where do you live?"
"All long shore, Sar, do now. I's going to see broader at their landing, but chiefly I lives in Day City."
"St. Louis, ah? Where do you sleep there of nights?"
"On their floor of their good baker's oven, Sar."
"In an oven? Whose, pray?
What baker, I should like to know, bakes such black bread in his oven, alongside of his nice white rolls, too? Who is that too charitable baker, pray?"
"Dar he be, with a broad grin lifting his tambourine high over his head. The son is the baker, eh? Yes, sir, in Dare City that good baker warms Dare stones for dis old darky when he sleeps out on Dare pavements o' nights. But that must be in the summer only, old boy. How about winter, when the cold Cossacks come clattering and jingling? How about winter, old boy? Den dis poor old darky shakes wery bad, I tell you, sar. Oh sar, oh. Don't speak obi dare winter, he added, with a reminiscent shiver, shuffling off into the thickest of the crowd, like a half-frozen black sheep nudging itself a cozy berth in the heart of the white flock. Thus far not very many pennies had been given him, and, used at last to his strange looks, the less polite passengers of those in that part of the boat began to get their fill of him as a curious object, when suddenly the negro more than revived their first interest by an expedient which, whether by chance or design, was a singular temptation at once to diversion and charity, though, even more than his crippled limbs, it put him on a canine footing. In short, as in appearance he seemed a dog, so now, in a merry way, like a dog he began to be treated. Still shuffling among the crowd, now and then he would pause, throwing back his head and, opening his mouth like an elephant for tossed apples at a menagerie, when, making a space before him, people would have about it a strange sort of pitch-penny game, the cripple's mouth being at once target and purse, and he hailing each expertly caught copper with a cracked bravura from his tambourine. To be the subject of almsgiving is trying, and to feel in duty bound to appear cheerfully grateful under the trial, must be still more so, but whatever his secret emotions, he swallowed them, while still retaining each copper this side the esophagus. And nearly always he grinned, and only once or twice did he wince, which was when certain coins, tossed by more playful almoners, came inconveniently nigh to his teeth, an accident whose unwelcomeness was not unedged by the circumstance that the pennies thus thrown proved buttons. While this game of charity was yet at its height, a limping, gimlet-eyed, sour-faced person it may be some discharged custom house officer, who, suddenly stripped of convenient means of support, had concluded to be avenged on government and humanity by making himself miserable for life, either by hating or suspecting everything and everybody this shallow unfortunate, after sundry sorry observations of the negro, began to croak out something about his deformity being a sham, got up for financial purposes, which immediately threw a damp upon the frolic benignities of the pitch-penny players. But that these suspicions came from one who himself on a wooden leg went halt, this did not appear to strike anybody present. That cripples, above all men should be companionable, or, at least, refrain from picking a fellow limp or to pieces, in short, should have a little sympathy in common misfortune, seemed not to occur to the company. Meantime, the negro's countenance, before marked with even more than patient good nature, drooped into a heavy-hearted expression, full of the most painful distress. So far abased beneath its proper physical level, that Newfoundland dog face turned in passively hopeless appeal, as if instinct told it that the right or the wrong might not have overmuch to do with whatever wayward mood superior intelligences might yield to. But instinct, though knowing, is yet a teacher set below reason, which itself says, in the grave words of Lysander in the comedy, after Puck has made a sage of him with his spell, dash. The will of man is by his reason swayed. So that, suddenly change as people may, in their dispositions, it is not always waywardness, but improved judgment, which, as in Lysander's case, or the present, operates with them. Yes, they began to scrutinize the negro curiously enough, when, emboldened by this evidence of the efficacy of his words, the wooden-legged man hobbled up to the negro, and, with the air of a beetle, would, to prove his alleged imposture on the spot, have stripped him and then driven him away, but was prevented by the crowd's clamor, now taking part with the poor fellow, against one who had just before turned nearly all minds the other way. So he with the wooden leg was forced to retire, when the rest, finding themselves left sole judges in the case, could not resist the opportunity of acting the part, not because it is a human weakness to take pleasure in sitting in judgment upon one in a box, as surely this unfortunate negro now was, but that it strangely sharpens human perceptions, when, instead of standing by and having their fellow feelings touched by the sight of an alleged culprit severely handled by some one justiciary, a crowd suddenly come to be all justiciaries in the same case themselves, as in Arkansas once, a man proved guilty, by law, of murder, but whose condemnation was deemed unjust by the people, so that they rescued him to try him themselves, whereupon, they, as it turned out, found him even guiltier than the court had done, and forthwith proceeded to execution, so that the gallows presented the truly warning spectacle of a man hanged by his friends. But not to such extremities, or anything like them, did the present crowd come, they, for the time, being content with putting the Negro fairly and discreetly to the question, among other things, asking him, had he any documentary proof, any plain paper about him, attesting that his case was not a spurious one. No, no, dis poor old darkie hain't not a dem wallooable papers, he wailed. But is there not someone who can speak a good word for you? Here said a person newly arrived from another part of the boat, a young Episcopal clergyman, in a long, straight-bodied black coat, small in stature, but manly, with a clear face and blue eye, innocence, tenderness, and good sense triumvirate in his air. Oh yes, G.E.man, he eagerly answered, as if his memory, before suddenly frozen up by cold charity, as suddenly thawed back into fluidity at the first kindly word. Oh yes, dar's aboard here a wery nice, good G.E.man wid a weed, and a G.E.man in a grey coat and white tie, what knows all about me, and a G.E.man wid a big book, too, and a yarb doctor, and a G.E.man in a yaller west, and a G.E.man wid a brass plate, and a G.E.man in a wiolet robe, and a G.E.man as is a sedger, and ever so many good, kind, honest G.E.man more aboard what knows me and will speak for me, God bless him, yes, and what knows me as well as dis poor old darkie knows hisself, God bless him. Oh, find him, he earnestly added, and let him come quick, and show you all, G.E.man, dat dis poor old darkie is wery well worthy of all you kind G.E.man's kind confidence. But how are we to find all these people in this great crowd? Was the question of a bystander, umbrella in hand, a middle-aged person, a country merchant apparently, whose natural good feeling had been made at least cautious by the unnatural ill feeling of the discharged custom house officer. Where are we to find them? Half rebukefully echoed the young Episcopal clergyman. I will go find one to begin with, he quickly added, and, with kind haste suiting the action to the word, away he went. Wild goose chase! Croaked he with the wooden leg, now again drawing nigh. Don't believe there's a soul of them aboard. Did ever beggar have such heaps of fine friends? He can walk fast enough when he tries, a good deal faster than I, but he can lie yet faster. He's some white operator, betwisted and painted up for a decoy. He and his friends are all humbugs. Have you no charity, friend? Here in self-subdued tones, singularly contrasted with his unsubdued person, said a Methodist minister, advancing, a tall, muscular, martial-looking man, a Tennessean by birth, who in the Mexican War had been volunteer chaplain to a volunteer rifle regiment. Charity is one thing, and truth is another, rejoined he with the wooden leg, he's a rascal, I say. But why not, friend, put as charitable a construction as one can upon the poor fellow? Said the soldier-like Methodist, with increased difficulty maintaining a pacific demeanor towards one whose own asperity seemed so little to entitle him to it, he looks honest, don't he? Looks are one thing, and facts are another, snapped out the other perversely, and as to your constructions, what construction can you put upon a rascal, but that a rascal he is? Be not such a Canada thistle, urged the Methodist, with something less of patience than before. Charity, man, charity. To where it belongs with your charity. To heaven with it. Again snapped out the other, diabolically, here on earth, true charity dotes, and false charity plots. Who betrays a fool with a kiss, the charitable fool has the charity to believe is in love with him, and the charitable knave on the stand gives charitable testimony for his comrade in the box. Surely, friend, returned the noble Methodist, with much ado restraining his still waxing indignation, surely, to say the least, you forget yourself. Apply at home, he continued, with exterior calmness tremulous with unkept emotion. Suppose, now, I should exercise no charity in judging your own character by the words which have fallen from you, what sort of vile, pitiless man do you think I would take you for? No doubt with a grin some such pitiless man as has lost his piety in much the same way that the jockey loses his honesty. And how is that, friend? Still conscientiously holding back the old Adam in him, as if it were a mastiff he had by the neck. Never you mind how it is with a sneer, but all horses ain't virtuous, no more than all mankind, and come close to, and much dealt with, some things are catching. When you find me a virtuous jockey, I will find you a benevolent wise man. Some insinuation there. More fool you that are puzzled by it. Reprobate! Cried the other, his indignation now at last almost boiling over, godless reprobate. If charity did not restrain me, I could call you by names you deserve. Could you, indeed? With an insolent sneer. Yea, and teach you charity on the spot, cried the goaded Methodist, suddenly catching this exasperating opponent by his shabby coat collar, and shaking him till his timber toe clattered on the deck like a ninepin. You took me for a non-combatant, did you? Thought, seedy coward that you are, that you could abuse a Christian with impunity. You find your mistake with another hearty shake. Well said and better done, church militant. Cried a voice. The white cravat against the world. Cried another. Bravo, bravo. Chorused many voices, with like enthusiasm taking sides with the resolute champion. You fools. Cried he with the wooden leg, writhing himself loose and inflamedly turning upon the throng, you flock of fools, under this captain of fools, in this ship of fools. With which exclamations, followed by idle threats against his admonisher, this condign victim to justice hobbled away, as disdaining to hold further argument with such a rabble. But his scorn was more than repaid by the hisses that chased him, in which the brave Methodist, satisfied with the rebuke already administered, was, to omit still better reasons, too magnanimous to join. All he said was, pointing towards the departing recusant, there he shambles off on his one lone leg, emblematic of his one-sided view of humanity. But trust your painted decoy, retorted the other from a distance, pointing back to the black cripple, and I have my revenge. But we ain't a-going to trust him, shouted back a voice. So much the better, he jeered back. Look you, he added, coming to a dead halt where he was, look you, I have been called a Canada thistle. Very good. And a seedy one, still better. And the seedy Canada thistle has been pretty well shaken among ye, best of all. Dare say some seed has been shaken out, and won't it spring though? And when it does spring, do you cut down the young thistles, and won't they spring the more? It's encouraging and coaxing 'em. Now, when with my thistles your farm shall be well stocked, why then you may abandon 'em. What does all that mean, now? Asked the country merchant, staring. Nothing, the foiled wolf's parting howl, said the Methodist. Spleen, much spleen, which is the rickety child of his evil heart of unbelief, it has made him mad. I suspect him for one naturally reprobate. Oh, friends, raising his arms as in the pulpit, oh beloved, how are we admonished by the melancholy spectacle of this raver? Let us profit by the lesson, and is it not this, that if, next to mistrusting providence, there be aught that man should pray against, it is against mistrusting his fellow man. I have been in madhouses full of tragic mopers, and seen there the end of suspicion, the cynic, in the moody madness muttering in the corner, for years a barren fixture there, head lopped over, gnawing his own lip, vulture of himself, while, by fits and starts, from the corner opposite came the grimace of the idiot at him. What an example, whispered one. Might deter Timon, was the response. Oh, oh, good G.E. man, have you no confidence in dis poor old darky? Now wailed the returning negro, who, during the late scene, had stumped apart in alarm. Confidence in you? Echoed he who had whispered, with abruptly changed air turning short round, that remains to be seen. I tell you what it is, Ebony, in similarly changed tones said he who had responded to the whisperer, yonder churl, pointing toward the wooden leg in the distance, is, no doubt, a churlish fellow enough, and I would not wish to be like him, but that is no reason why you may not be some sort of Black Jeremy Diddler. No confidence in dis poor old darky, den? Before giving you our confidence, said a third, we will wait the report of the kind gentleman who went in search of one of your friends who was to speak for you. Very likely, in that case, said a fourth, we shall wait here till Christmas. Shouldn't wonder, did we not see that kind gentleman again. After seeking a while in vain, he will conclude he has been made a fool of, and so not return to us for pure shame. Fact is, I begin to feel a little qualmish about the darky myself. Something queer about this darky, depend upon it. Once more the negro wailed, and turning in despair from the last speaker, imploringly caught the Methodist by the skirt of his coat. But a change had come over that before impassioned intercessor. With an irresolute and troubled air, he mutely eyed the suppliant, against whom, somehow, by what seemed instinctive influences, the distrusts first set on foot were now generally reviving, and, if anything, with added severity. No confidence in dis poor old darky, yet again wailed the negro, letting go the coat skirts and turning appealingly all round him. Yes, my poor fellow, I have confidence in you, now exclaimed the country merchant before named, whom the negro's appeal, coming so piteously on the heel of pitilessness, seemed at last humanely to have decided in his favor. And here is some proof of my trust, with which, tucking his umbrella under his arm, and diving down his hand into his pocket, he fished forth a purse, and, accidentally, along with it, his business card, which, unobserved, dropped to the deck. Here, my poor fellow, he continued, extending a half dollar. Not more grateful for the coin than the kindness, the cripple's face glowed like a polished copper saucepan, and shuffling a pace nigher, with one upstretched hand he received the alms, while, as unconsciously, his one advanced leather stump covered the card. Done in despite of the general sentiment, the good deed of the merchant was not, perhaps, without its unwelcome return from the crowd, since that good deed seemed somehow to convey to them a sort of reproach. Still again, and more pertinaciously than ever, the cry arose against the negro, and still again he wailed forth his lament and appeal among other things, repeating that the friends, of whom already he had partially run off the list, would freely speak for him, would anybody go find them? "Why don't you go find them yourself?" demanded a gruff boatman. "How can I go find him myself? Dis poor old game-legged darkey's friends must come to him. Oh, war is dat good friend of dis darkey's, dat good man wid de weed?" At this point, a steward ringing a bell came along, summoning all persons who had not got their tickets to step to the captain's office, an announcement which speedily thinned the throng about the black cripple, who himself soon forlornly stumped out of sight, probably on much the same errand as the rest. Chapter 4. Renewal of Old Acquaintance. "How do you do, Mr. Roberts? Eh? Don't you know me?" "No, certainly." The crowd about the captain's office, having in good time melted away, the above encounter took place in one of the side balconies astern, between a man in mourning clean and respectable, but none of the glossiest, a long weed on his hat, and the country merchant before mentioned, whom, with the familiarity of an old acquaintance, the former had accosted. "Is it possible, my dear sir," resumed he with the weed, "that you do not recall my countenance? Why, yours I recall distinctly as if but half an hour, instead of half an age, had passed since I saw you. Don't you recall me, now? Look harder." "In my conscience truly I protest, honestly bewildered, bless my soul, sir, I don't know you really, really. But stay, he hurriedly added, not without gratification, glancing up at the crape on the stranger's hat, "stay, yes, seems to me, though I have not the pleasure of personally knowing you, yet I am pretty sure I have at least heard of you, and recently too, quite recently. A poor negro aboard here referred to you, among others, for a character, I think." "Oh, the cripple. Poor fellow. I know him well. They found me. I have said all I could for him. I think I abated their distrust. Would I could have been of more substantial service. And apropos, sir," he added, "now that it strikes me, allow me to ask, whether this circumstance of one man, however humble, referring for a character to another man, however afflicted, does not argue more or less of moral worth in the latter?" The good merchant looked puzzled. "Still you don't recall my countenance?" "Still does truth compel me to say that I cannot, despite my best efforts," was the reluctantly candid reply. "Can I be so changed? Look at me. Or is it I who am mistaken? Are you not, sir, Henry Roberts, forwarding merchant, of Wheeling, Pennsylvania? Pray, now, if you use the advertisement of business cards, and happen to have one with you, just look at it, and see whether you are not the man I take you for." "Why, a bit chafed, perhaps, I hope I know myself. And yet self-knowledge is thought by some not so easy. Who knows, my dear sir, but for a time you may have taken yourself for somebody else. Stranger things have happened." The good merchant stared. "To come to particulars, my dear sir, I met you, now some 6 years back, at Braid Brothers and Company's office, I think. I was traveling for a Philadelphia house. The senior Braid introduced us, you remember, some business chat followed, then you forced me home with you to a family tea, and a family time we had. Have you forgotten about the urn, and what I said about Werter's Charlotte, and the bread and butter, and that capital story you told of the large loaf? 100 times since, I have laughed over it. At least you must recall my name, Ringman, John Ringman." "Large loaf? Invited you to tea? Ringman? Ringman? Ring? Ring?" "Ah, sir," sadly smiling, "don't ring the changes that way. I see you have a faithless memory, Mr. Roberts. But trust in the faithfulness of mine." "Well, to tell the truth, in some things my memory ain't of the very best," was the honest rejoinder. "But still," he perplexedly added, "still I. Oh, sir, suffice it that it is as I say. Doubt not that we are all well acquainted. But I don't like this going dead against my own memory, I. But didn't you admit, my dear sir, that in some things this memory of yours is a little faithless? Now, those who have faithless memories, should they not have some little confidence in the less faithless memories of others? But, of this friendly chat and tea, I have not the slightest." "I see, I see, quite erased from the tablet. Pray, sir, with a sudden illumination, about 6 years back, did it happen to you to receive any injury on the head? Surprising effects have arisen from such a cause. Not alone unconsciousness as to events for a greater or less time immediately subsequent to the injury, but likewise strange to add oblivion, entire and incurable, as to events embracing a longer or shorter period immediately preceding it, that is, when the mind at the time was perfectly sensible of them, and fully competent also to register them in the memory, and did in fact so do, but all in vain, for all was afterwards bruised out by the injury. After the first start, the merchant listened with what appeared more than ordinary interest. The other proceeded. In my boyhood I was kicked by a horse, and lay insensible for a long time. Upon recovering, what a blank! No faintest trace in regard to how I had come near the horse, or what horse it was, or where it was, or that it was a horse at all that had brought me to that pass. For the knowledge of those particulars I am indebted solely to my friends, in whose statements, I need not say, I place implicit reliance, since particulars of some sort there must have been, and why should they deceive me? You see, sir, the mind is ductile, very much so, but images, ductilely received into it, need a certain time to harden and bake in their impressions, otherwise such a casualty as I speak of will in an instant obliterate them, as though they had never been. We are but clay, sir, potter's clay, as the good book says, clay, feeble, and too yielding clay. But I will not philosophize. Tell me, was it your misfortune to receive any concussion upon the brain about the period I speak of? If so, I will with pleasure supply the void in your memory by more minutely rehearsing the circumstances of our acquaintance. The growing interest betrayed by the merchant had not relaxed as the other proceeded. After some hesitation, indeed, something more than hesitation, he confessed that, though he had never received any injury of the sort named, yet, about the time in question, he had in fact been taken with a brain fever, losing his mind completely for a considerable interval. He was continuing, when the stranger with much animation exclaimed, "There now, you see, I was not wholly mistaken. That brain fever accounts for it all. Nay, but..." "Pardon me, Mr. Roberts," respectfully interrupting him, "but time is short, and I have something private and particular to say to you. Allow me." Mr. Roberts, good man, could but acquiesce, and the two having silently walked to a less public spot, the manner of the man with the weed suddenly assumed a seriousness almost painful. What might be called a writhing expression stole over him. He seemed struggling with some disastrous necessity and kept. He made one or two attempts to speak, but words seemed to choke him. His companion stood in humane surprise, wondering what was to come. At length, with an effort mastering his feelings, in a tolerably composed tone he spoke. "If I remember, you are a mason, Mr. Roberts?" "Yes, yes." Averting himself a moment, as to recover from a return of agitation, the stranger grasped the other's hand, "And would you not loan a brother a shilling if he needed it?" The merchant started, apparently, almost as if to retreat. "Ah, Mr. Roberts, I trust you are not one of those businessmen, who make a business of never having to do with unfortunates. For God's sake don't leave me. I have something on my heart on my heart. Under deplorable circumstances thrown among strangers, utter strangers. I want a friend in whom I may confide. Yours, Mr. Roberts, is almost the first known face I've seen for many weeks." It was so sudden an outburst, the interview offered such a contrast to the scene around, that the merchant, though not used to be very indiscreet, yet, being not entirely inhumane, remained not entirely unmoved. The other, still tremulous, resumed. "I need not say, sir, how it cuts me to the soul, to follow up a social salutation with such words as have just been mine. I know that I jeopardize your good opinion. But I can't help it, necessity knows no law, and heeds no risk. Sir, we are masons, one more step aside, I will tell you my story." In a low, half-suppressed tone, he began it. Judging from his auditor's expression, it seemed to be a tale of singular interest, involving calamities against which no integrity, no forethought, no energy, no genius, no piety, could guard. At every disclosure, the hearer's commiseration increased. No sentimental pity. As the story went on, he drew from his wallet a banknote, but after a while, at some still more unhappy revelation, changed it for another, probably of a somewhat larger amount, which, when the story was concluded, with an air studiously disclamatory of almsgiving, he put into the stranger's hands, who, on his side, with an air studiously disclamatory of almstaking, put it into his pocket. Assistance being received, The stranger's manner assumed a kind and degree of decorum which, under the circumstances, seemed almost coldness. After some words, not over ardent, and yet not exactly inappropriate, he took leave, making a bow which had one knows not what of a certain chastened independence about it, as if misery, however burdensome, could not break down self-respect, nor gratitude, however deep, humiliate a gentleman. He was hardly yet out of sight, when he paused as if thinking, then with hastened steps returning to the merchant, "I am just reminded that the president, who is also transfer agent, of the Black Rapids Coal Company, happens to be on board here, and, having been subpoenaed as witness in a stock case on the docket in Kentucky, has his transfer book with him. A month since, in a panic contrived by artful alarmists, some credulous stockholders sold out, but, to frustrate the aim of the alarmists, the company, previously advised of their scheme, so managed it as to get into its own hands those sacrificed shares, resolved that, since a spurious panic must be, the panic makers should be no gainers by it. The company, I hear, is now ready, but not anxious, to redispose of those shares, and having obtained them at their depressed value, will now sell them at par, though, prior to the panic, they were held at a handsome figure above. That the readiness of the company to do this is not generally known, is shown by the fact that the stock still stands on the transfer book in the company's name, offering to one in funds a rare chance for investment. 4. The panic subsiding more and more every day, it will daily be seen how it originated, confidence will be more than restored, there will be a reaction, from the stock's descent its rise will be higher than from no fall, the holders trusting themselves to fear no second fate. Having listened at first with curiosity, at last with interest, the merchant replied to the effect, that some time since, through friends concerned with it, he had heard of the company, and heard well of it, but was ignorant that there had latterly been fluctuations. He added that he was no speculator, that hitherto he had avoided having to do with stocks of any sort, but in the present case he really felt something like being tempted. "Pray, in conclusion, do you think that upon a pinch anything could be transacted on board here with the transfer agent? Are you acquainted with him?" "Not personally. I but happened to hear that he was a passenger. For the rest, though it might be somewhat informal, the gentleman might not object to doing a little business on board. Along the Mississippi, you know, business is not so ceremonious as at the East." "True," returned the merchant, and looked down a moment in thought, then, raising his head quickly, said, in a tone not so benign as his wonted one, "This would seem a rare chance. Indeed, why, upon first hearing it, did you not snatch at it? I mean for yourself."
"I? Would it had been possible?" Not without some emotion was this said, and not without some embarrassment was the reply. "Ah, yes, I had forgotten." Upon this, the stranger regarded him with mild gravity, not a little disconcerting, the more so, as there was in it what seemed the aspect not alone of the superior, but, as it were, the rebuker, which sort of bearing, in a beneficiary towards his benefactor, looked strangely enough, nonetheless, that, somehow, it sat not altogether unbecomingly upon the beneficiary, being free from anything like the appearance of assumption, and mixed with a kind of painful conscientiousness, as though nothing but a proper sense of what he owed to himself swayed him. At length he spoke. "To reproach a penniless man with remissness in not availing himself of an opportunity for pecuniary investment, but, no, no, it was forgetfulness, and this, charity will impute to some lingering effect of that unfortunate brain fever, which, as to occurrences dating yet further back, disturbed Mr. Roberts's memory still more seriously." "As to that," said the merchant, rallying, "I am not. Pardon me, but you must admit, that just now, an unpleasant distrust, however vague, was yours. Ah, shallow as it is, yet, how subtle a thing is suspicion, which at times can invade the humanest of hearts and wisest of heads. But, enough. My object, sir, in calling your attention to this stock, is by way of acknowledgement of your goodness. I but seek to be grateful. If my information leads to nothing, you must remember the motive." He bowed, and finally retired, leaving Mr. Roberts not wholly without self-reproach, for having momentarily indulged injurious thoughts against one who, it was evident, was possessed of a self-respect which forbade his indulging them himself. Chapter 5. The man with the weed makes it and even question whether he be a great sage or a great simpleton. Well, there is sorrow in the world, but goodness too, and goodness that is not greenness, either, no more than sorrow is. Dear good man. Poor beating heart. It was the man with the weed, not very long after quitting the merchant, murmuring to himself with his hand to his side like one with the heart disease. Meditation over kindness received seemed to have softened him something, too, it may be, beyond what might, perhaps, have been looked for from one whose unwanted self-respect in the hour of need, and in the act of being aided, might have appeared to some not wholly unlike pride out of place, and pride, in any place, is seldom very feeling. But the truth, perhaps, is, that those who are least touched with advice, besides being not unsusceptible to goodness, are sometimes the ones whom the ruling sense of propriety makes appear cold, if not thankless, under a favor. For, at such a time, to be full of warm, earnest words, and heartfelt protestations, is to create a scene, and well-bred people dislike few things more than that, which would seem to look as if the world did not relish earnestness, but, not so, because the world, being earnest itself, likes an earnest scene, and an earnest man, very well, but only in their place the stage. See what sad work they make of it, who, ignorant of this, flame out an Irish enthusiasm and with Irish sincerity, to a benefactor, who, if a man of sense and respectability, as well as kindliness, can but be more or less annoyed by it, and, if of a nervously fastidious nature, as some are, may be led to think almost as much less favorably of the beneficiary paining him by his gratitude, as if he had been guilty of its contrary, instead only of an indiscretion. But, beneficiaries who know better, though they may feel as much, if not more, neither inflict such pain, nor are inclined to run any risk of so doing. And these, being wise, are the majority. By which one sees how inconsiderate those persons are, who, from the absence of its officious manifestations in the world, complain that there is not much gratitude extant, when the truth is, that there is as much of it as there is of modesty, but, both being for the most part votarists of the shade, for the most part keep out of sight. What started this was, to account, if necessary, for the changed air of the man with the weed, who, throwing off in private the cold garb of decorum, and so giving warmly loose to his genuine heart, seemed almost transformed into another being. This subdued air of softness, too, was toned with melancholy, melancholy unreserved, a thing which, however at variance with propriety, still the more attested his earnestness, for one knows not how it is, but it sometimes happens that, where earnestness is, there, also, is melancholy. At the time, he was leaning over the rail at the boat's side, in his pensiveness, unmindful of another pensive figure near a young gentleman with a swan neck, wearing a ladylike open shirt collar, thrown back, and tied with a black ribbon. From a square, tableted brooch, curiously engraved with Greek characters, he seemed a collegian not improbably, a sophomore on his travels, possibly, his first. A small book bound in Roman vellum was in his hand. Overhearing his murmuring neighbor, the youth regarded him with some surprise, not to say interest. But, singularly for a collegian, being apparently of a retiring nature, he did not speak, when the other still more increased his diffidence by changing from soliloquy to colloquy, in a manner strangely mixed of familiarity and pathos. "Ah, who is this? You did not hear me, my young friend, did you? Why, you, too, look sad. My melancholy is not catching." "Sir, sir," stammered the other. "Pray, now," with a sort of sociable sorrowfulness, slowly sliding along the rail, "pray, now, my young friend, what volume have you there? Give me leave," gently drawing it from him. "Tacitus." Then opening it at random, "read, in general a black and shameful period lies before me. Dear young sir," touching his arm alarmedly, "don't read this book. It is poison, moral poison. Even were there truth in Tacitus, such truth would have the operation of falsity, and so still be poison, moral poison. Too well I know this Tacitus. In my college days he came near souring me into cynicism. Yes, I began to turn down my collar, and go about with a disdainfully joyless expression. Sir, sir, aye. Trust me. Now, young friend, perhaps you think that Tacitus, like me, is only melancholy, but he's more, he's ugly. A vast difference, young sir, between the melancholy view and the ugly. The one may show the world still beautiful, not so the other. The one may be compatible with benevolence, the other not. The one may deepen insight, the other shallows it. Drop Tacitus. Phrenologically, my young friend, you would seem to have a well-developed head, and large, but cribbed within the ugly view, the Tacitus view, your large brain, like your large ox in the contracted field, will but starve the more. And don't dream, as some of you students may, that, by taking this same ugly view, the deeper meanings of the deeper books will so alone become revealed to you. Drop Tacitus. His subtlety is falsity, to him, in his double refined anatomy of human nature, is well applied the scripture saying there is a subtle man, and the same is deceived. Drop Tacitus. Come, now, let me throw the book overboard.
Sir, aye. Not a word, I know just what is in your mind, and that is just what I am speaking to.
Yes, learn from me that, though the sorrows of the world are great, its wickedness that is, its ugliness is small. Much cause to pity man, little to distrust him. I myself have known adversity, and know it still. But for that, do I turn cynic? No, number it a small beer that sours. To my fellow creatures I owe alleviations. So, whatever I may have undergone, it but deepens my confidence in my kind. Now, then, winningly, this book will you let me drown it for you?
Really, sir, I see.
But of course you read Tacitus in order to aid you in understanding human nature as if truth was ever got at by libel. My young friend, if to know human nature is your object, drop Tacitus and go north to the cemeteries of Auburn and Greenwood.
Upon my word, aye.
Nay, I foresee all that. But you carry Tacitus, that shallow Tacitus.
What do I carry?
See producing a pocket volume Akenside his pleasures of imagination. One of these days you will know it. Whatever our lot, we should read serene and cheery books, fitted to inspire love and trust. But Tacitus. I have long been of opinion that these classics are the bane of colleges, for not to hint of the immorality of Ovid, Horace, Anacreon, and the rest, and the dangerous theology of Aeschylus and others, where will one find views so injurious to human nature as in Thucydides, Juvenal, Lucian, but more particularly Tacitus? When I consider that, ever since the revival of learning, these classics have been the favorites of successive generations of students and studious men, I tremble to think of that mass of unsuspected heresy on every vital topic which for centuries must have simmered unsurmised in the heart of Christendom. But Tacitus, he is the most extraordinary example of a heretic, not one iota of confidence in his kind. What a mockery that such an one should be reputed wise, and Thucydides be esteemed the statesman's manual. But Tacitus, I hate Tacitus, not, though, I trust, with the hate that sins, but a righteous hate. Without confidence himself, Tacitus destroys it in all his readers. Destroys confidence, paternal confidence, of which God knows that there is in this world none to spare. For, comparatively inexperienced as you are, my dear young friend, did you never observe how little, very little, confidence, there is? I mean between man and man, more particularly between stranger and stranger. In a sad world it is the saddest fact. Confidence. I have sometimes almost thought that confidence is fled, that confidence is the new Astrea emigrated, vanished, gone. Then softly sliding nearer, with the softest air, quivering down and looking up, could you now, my dear young sir, under such circumstances, by way of experiment, simply have confidence in me? From the outset, the sophomore, as has been seen, had struggled with an ever-increasing embarrassment, arising, perhaps, from such strange remarks coming from a stranger, such persistent and prolonged remarks, too. In vain had he more than once sought to break the spell by venturing a deprecatory or leave-taking word. In vain. Somehow, the stranger fascinated him. Little wonder, then, that, when the appeal came, he could hardly speak, but, as before intimated, being apparently of a retiring nature, abruptly retired from the spot, leaving the chagrined stranger to wander away in the opposite direction. Chapter 6. At the outset of which certain passengers proved deaf to the call of charity.
Dash you pish! Why will the captain suffer these begging fellows on board? These pettish words were breathed by a well-to-do gentleman in a ruby-colored velvet vest, and with a ruby-colored cheek, a ruby-headed cane in his hand, to a man in a gray coat and white tie, who, shortly after the interview last described, had accosted him for contributions to a widow and orphan asylum recently founded among the Seminoles. Upon a cursory view, this last person might have seemed, like the man with the weed, one of the less unrefined children of misfortune, but, on a closer observation, his countenance revealed little of sorrow, though much of sanctity. With added words of touchy disgust, the well-to-do gentleman hurried away. But, though repulsed, and rudely, the man in gray did not reproach, for a time patiently remaining in the chilly loneliness to which he had been left, his countenance, however, not without token of latent though chase and reliance. At length an old gentleman, somewhat bulky, drew nigh, and from him also a contribution was sought.
Look, you, coming to a dead halt, and scowling upon him. Look, you, swelling his bulk out before him like a swaying balloon. Look, you, you on others' behalf ask for money. You, a fellow with a face as long as my arm. Hark ye, now, there is such a thing as gravity,
and in condemned felons it may be genuine, but of long faces there are three sorts, that of Grief Strudge, that of the Lantern-Jawed Man, and that of the Impostor. You know best which yours is. Heaven give you more charity, sir. And you less hypocrisy, sir. With which words, the hard-hearted old gentleman marched off. While the other still stood forlorn, the young clergyman, before introduced, passing that way, catching a chance sight of him, seemed suddenly struck by some recollection, and, after a moment's pause, hurried up with, "Your pardon, but shortly since I was all over looking for you." "For me?" As marveling that one of so little account should be sought for. "Yes, for you. Do you know anything about the Negro, apparently a cripple, aboard here? Is he, or is he not, what he seems to be?" "Ah, poor Guinea. Have you, too, been distrusted? You, upon whom nature has placarded the evidence of your claims? Then you do really know him, and he is quite worthy? It relieves me to hear it, much relieves me. Come, let us go find him, and see what can be done." Another instance that confidence may come too late. I am sorry to say that at the last landing I myself just happening to catch sight of him on the gangway plank assisted the cripple ashore. No time to talk, only to help. He may not have told you, but he has a brother in that vicinity. Really, I regret his going without my seeing him again, regret it, more, perhaps, than you can readily think. You see, shortly after leaving St. Louis, he was on the forecastle, and there, with many others, I saw him, and put trust in him, so much so, that, to convince those who did not, I, at his entreaty, went in search of you, you being one of several individuals he mentioned, and whose personal appearance he more or less described, individuals who he said would willingly speak for him. But, after diligent search, not finding you, and catching no glimpse of any of the others he had enumerated, doubts were at last suggested, but doubts indirectly originating, as I can but think, from prior distrust unfeelingly proclaimed by another. Still, certain it is, I began to suspect. Ha, ha, ha. A sort of laugh more like a groan than a laugh, and yet, somehow, it seemed intended for a laugh. Both turned, and the young clergyman started at seeing the wooden-legged man close behind him, morosely grave as a criminal judge with a mustard plaster on his back. In the present case the mustard plaster might have been the memory of certain recent biting rebuffs and mortifications. "Wouldn't think it was I who laughed, would you? But who is it you laughed at? Or rather, tried to laugh at?" demanded the young clergyman, flushing, "me? Neither you nor anyone within 1,000 miles of you. But perhaps you don't believe it." "If you are of a suspicious temper, he might not," interposed the man in grey calmly. "It is one of the imbecilities of the suspicious person to fancy that every stranger, however absent-minded, he sees so much as smiling or gesturing to himself in any odd sort of way, is secretly making him his butt. In some moods, the movements of an entire street, as the suspicious man walks down it, will seem an express pantomimic jeer at him. In short, the suspicious man kicks himself with his own foot. Whoever can do that, 10 to 1 he saves other folks' soul leather," said the wooden-legged man with a crusty attempt at humor. But with augmented grin and squirm, turning directly upon the young clergyman, "You still think it was you I was laughing at, just now. To prove your mistake, I will tell you what I was laughing at, a story I happened to call to mind just then." Whereupon, in his porcupine way, and with sarcastic details, unpleasant to repeat, he related a story, which might, perhaps, in a good-natured version, be rendered as follows. A certain Frenchman of New Orleans, an old man, less slender in purse than limb, happening to attend the theater one evening, was so charmed with the character of a faithful wife, as there represented to the life, that nothing would do but he must marry upon it. So, marry he did, a beautiful girl from Tennessee, who had first attracted his attention by her liberal mold, and was subsequently recommended to him through her kin, for her equally liberal education and disposition. Though large, the praise proved not too much. For, ere long, rumor more than corroborated it, by whispering that the lady was liberal to a fault. But though various circumstances, which by most Benedicts would have been deemed all but conclusive, were duly recited to the old Frenchman by his friends, yet such was his confidence that not a syllable would he credit, till, chancing one night to return unexpectedly from a journey, upon entering his apartment, a stranger burst from the alcove, "Bigger!" cried he, "now I begin to suspect." His story told, the wooden-legged man threw back his head, and gave vent to a long, gasping, rasping sort of taunting cry, intolerable as that of a high-pressure engine jeering off steam, and that done, with apparent satisfaction hobbled away. "Who is that scoffer?" said the man in grey, not without warmth. Who is he, who even were truth on his tongue, his way of speaking it would make truth almost offensive as falsehood? Who is he?
He who I mentioned to you as having boasted his suspicion of the Negro, replied the young clergyman, recovering from disturbance, in short, the person to whom I ascribed the origin of my own distrust. He maintained that Guinea was some white scoundrel, betwisted and painted up for a decoy.
Yes, these were his very words, I think.
Impossible. He could not be so wrong-headed.
Pray, will you call him back, and let me ask him if he were really in earnest?
The other complied, and, at length, after no few surly objections, prevailed upon the one-legged individual to return for a moment. Upon which, the man in gray thus addressed him, "This reverend gentleman tells me, sir, that a certain cripple, a poor Negro, is by you considered an ingenious impostor. Now, I am not unaware that there are some persons in this world, who, unable to give better proof of being wise, take a strange delight in showing what they think they have sagaciously read in mankind by uncharitable suspicions of them. I hope you are not one of these. In short, would you tell me now, whether you are not merely joking in the notion you threw out about the Negro? Would you be so kind?"
"No, I won't be so kind, I'll be so cruel."
"As you please about that."
"Well, he's just what I said he was."
"A white masquerading as a black?"
"Exactly."
The man in gray glanced at the young clergyman a moment, then quietly whispered to him, "I thought you represented your friend here as a very distrustful sort of person, but he appears endued with a singular credulity. Tell me, sir, do you really think that a white could look the Negro so? For one, I should call it pretty good acting."
"Not much better than any other man acts."
"How? Does all the world act? Am I, for instance, an actor? Is my reverend friend here, too, a performer?"
"Yes, don't you both perform acts? To do, is to act, so all doers are actors."
"You trifle. I ask again, if a white, how could he look the Negro so?"
"Never saw the Negro minstrels, I suppose?"
"Yes, but they are apt to overdo the ebony, exemplifying the old saying, not more just than charitable, that the devil is never so black as he is painted. But his limbs, if not a cripple, how could he twist his limbs so?
How do other hypocritical beggars twist theirs?
Easy enough to see how they are hoisted up."
"The sham is evident, then?"
"To the discerning eye, with a horrible screw of his gimlet one."
"Well, where is Guinea?"
said the man in gray, "where is he? Let us at once find him, and refute beyond cavil this injurious hypothesis."
"Do so," cried the one-eyed man. "I'm just in the humor now for having him found, and leaving the streaks of these fingers on his paint, as the lion leaves the streaks of his nails on a Kaffir. They wouldn't let me touch him before.
Yes, find him, I'll make wool fly, and him after."
"You forget," here said the young clergyman to the man in gray, "that yourself helped poor Guinea ashore."
So I did, how unfortunate. But look now, to the other, I think that without personal proof I can convince you of your mistake. For I put it to you, is it reasonable to suppose that a man with brains, sufficient to act such a part as you say, would take all that trouble, and run all that hazard, for the mere sake of those few paltry coppers, which, I hear, was all he got for his pains, if pains they were?"
"That puts the case irrefutably," said the young clergyman, with a challenging glance towards the one-legged man.
"You two greenhorns. Money, you think, is the sole motive to pains and hazard, deception and deviltry, in this world. How much money did the devil make by gulling Eve?" Whereupon he hobbled off again with a repetition of his intolerable jeer.
The man in gray stood silently eyeing his retreat a while, and then, turning to his companion, said, "A bad man, a dangerous man, a man to be put down in any Christian community. And this was he who was the means of begetting your distrust? Ah, we should shut our ears to distrust, and keep them open only for its opposite. You advance a principle, which, if I had acted upon it this morning, I should have spared myself what I now feel. That but one man, and he with one leg, should have such ill power given him, his one sour word leavening into congenial sourness, as, to my knowledge, it did, the dispositions, before sweet enough, of a numerous company. But, as I hinted, with me at the time his ill words went for nothing, the same as now, only afterwards they had effect, and I confess, this puzzles me.
It should not. With humane minds, the spirit of distrust works something as certain potions do. It is a spirit which may enter such minds, and yet, for a time, longer or shorter, lie in them quiescent, but only the more deplorable its ultimate activity. An uncomfortable solution, for,
Since that baneful man did but just now a new drop on me his bane, how shall I be sure that my present exemption from its effects will be lasting?
You cannot be sure, but you can strive against it.
How?
By strangling the least symptom of distrust, of any sort, which hereafter, upon whatever provocation, may arise in you.
I will do so. Then added as in soliloquy, indeed, indeed, I was to blame in standing passive under such influences as that one-legged man's. My conscience upbraids me.
The poor negro, you see him occasionally, perhaps?
No, not often, though in a few days, as it happens, my engagements will call me to the neighborhood of his present retreat, and, no doubt, honest Guinea, who is a grateful soul, will come to see me there.
Then you have been his benefactor?
His benefactor? I did not say that. I have known him.
Take this mite. Hand it to Guinea when you see him, say it comes from one who has full belief in his honesty, and is sincerely sorry for having indulged, however transiently, in a contrary thought.
I accept the trust. And, by the way, since you are of this truly charitable nature, you will not turn away an appeal in behalf of the Seminole Widow and Orphan Asylum?
I have not heard of that charity.
But recently founded.
After a pause, the clergyman was irresolutely putting his hand in his pocket, when, caught by something in his companion's expression, he eyed him inquisitively, almost uneasily.
Ah, well, smiled the other wanly, if that subtle bane, we were speaking of but just now, is so soon beginning to work, in vain my appeal to you. Goodbye.
Nay, not untouched, you do me injustice, instead of indulging present suspicions, I had rather make amends for previous ones. Here is something for your asylum.
Not much, but every drop helps.
Of course you have papers?
Of course, producing a memorandum book and pencil.
Let me take down name and amount.
We publish these names.
And now let me give you a little history of our asylum, and the providential way in which it was started.
Chapter 7. A Gentleman with Gold Sleeve Buttons.
At an interesting point of the narration, and at the moment when, with much curiosity, indeed, urgency, the narrator was being particularly questioned upon that point, he was, as it happened, altogether diverted both from it and his story, by just then catching sight of a gentleman who had been standing in sight from the beginning, but, until now, as it seemed, without being observed by him.
"Pardon me," said he, rising, "but yonder is one who I know will contribute, and largely. Don't take it amiss if I quit you."
"Go, duty before all things," was the conscientious reply. The stranger was a man of more than winsome aspect. There he stood apart and in repose, and yet, by his mere look, lured the man in gray from his story, much as, by its graciousness of bearing, some full-leaved elm, alone in a meadow, lures the noon sickleman to throw down his sheaves, and come and apply for the alms of its shade. But, considering that goodness is no such rare thing among men the world familiarly know the noun, a common one in every language, it was curious that what so signalized the stranger, and made him look like a kind of foreigner, among the crowd, as to some it make him appear more or less unreal in this portraiture, was but the expression of so prevalent a quality. Such goodness seemed his, allied with such fortune, that, so far as his own personal experience could have gone, scarcely could he have known ill, physical or moral, and as for knowing or suspecting the latter in any serious degree, supposing such degree of it to be, by observation or philosophy, for that, probably, his nature, by its opposition, imperfectly qualified, or from it wholly exempted. For the rest, he might have been 55, perhaps 60, but tall, rosy, between plump and portly, with a primy, palmy air, and for the time and place, not to hint of his years, dressed with a strangely festive finish and elegance. The inner side of his coat skirts was of white satin, which might have looked especially inappropriate, had it not seemed less a bit of mere tailoring than something of an emblem, as it were, an involuntary emblem, let us say, that what seemed so good about him was not all outside, no, the fine covering had a still finer lining. Upon one hand he wore a white kid glove, but the other hand, which was ungloved, looked hardly less white. Now, as the Fidel, like most steamboats, was upon deck a little soot streaked here and there, especially about the railings, it was marvel how, under such circumstances, these hands retain their spotlessness. But, if you watch them a while, you noticed that they avoided touching anything, you noticed, in short, that a certain negro body servant, whose hand's nature had dyed black, perhaps with the same purpose that Miller's were white, this negro servant's hands did most of his master's handling for him, having to do with dirt on his account, but not to his prejudices. But if, with the same undefiledness of consequences to himself,
A gentleman could also send by deputy, how shocking would that be? But it is not permitted to be, and even if it were, no judicious moralist would make proclamation of it. This gentleman, therefore, there is reason to affirm, was one who, like the Hebrew governor, knew how to keep his hands clean, and who never in his life happened to be run suddenly against by hurrying house painter, or sweep, in a word, one whose very good luck it was to be a very good man. Not that he looked as if he were a kind of Wilberforce at all, that superior merit, probably, was not his, nothing in his manner bespoke him righteous, but only good, and though to be good is much below being righteous, and though there is a difference between the two, yet not, it is to be hoped, so incompatible as that a righteous man cannot be a good man, though, conversely, in the pulpit it has been with much cogency urged, that a merely good man, that is, one good merely by his nature, is so far from thereby being righteous, that nothing short of a total change and conversion can make him so, which is something which no honest mind, well read in the history of righteousness, will care to deny. Nevertheless, since St. Paul himself, agreeing in a sense with the pulpit distinction, though not altogether in the pulpit deduction, and also pretty plainly intimating which of the two qualities in question enjoys his apostolic preference, I say, since St. Paul has so meaningly said, that, scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet peradventure for a good man some would even dare to die, therefore, when we repeat of this gentleman, that he was only a good man, whatever else by severe censors may be objected to him, it is still to be hoped that his goodness will not at least be considered criminal in him. At all events, no man, not even a righteous man, would think it quite right to commit this gentleman to prison for the crime, extraordinary as he might deem it, more especially, as, until everything could be known, there would be some chance that the gentleman might after all be quite as innocent of it as he himself. It was pleasant to mark the good man's reception of the salute of the righteous man, that is, the man in gray, his inferior, apparently, not more in the social scale than in stature. Like the benign Almagen, the good man seemed to wave the canopy of his goodness over that suitor, not in conceited condescension, but with that even amenity of true majesty, which can be kind to anyone without stooping to it. To the plea in behalf of the Seminole widows and orphans, the gentleman, after a question or two duly answered, responded by producing an ample pocketbook in the good old capacious style, a fine green French morocco in workmanship, bound with silk of the same color, not to omit bills crisp with newness, fresh from the bank, no muckworm's grime upon them. Lucre those bills might be, but as yet having been kept unspotted from the world, not of the filthy sort. Placing now three of those virgin bills in the applicant's hands, he hoped that the smallness of the contribution would be pardoned, to tell the truth, and this at last accounted for his toilet. He was bound but a short run down the river, to attend, in a festive grove, the afternoon wedding of his niece, so did not carry much money with him. The other was about expressing his thanks when the gentleman in his pleasant way checked him. The gratitude was on the other side. To him, he said, charity was in one sense not an effort, but a luxury, against too great indulgence in which his steward, a humorist, had sometimes admonished him. In some general talk which followed, relative to organized modes of doing good, the gentleman expressed his regrets that so many benevolent societies as there were, here and there isolated in the land, should not act in concert by coming together, in the way that already in each society the individuals composing it had done, which would result, he thought, in like advantages upon a larger scale. Indeed, such a confederation might, perhaps, be attended with as happy results as politically attended that of the states. Upon his hitherto moderate enough companion, this suggestion had an effect illustrative in a sort of that notion of Socrates, that the soul is a harmony, for as the sound of a flute, in any particular key, will, it is said, audibly affect the corresponding chord of any harp in good tune, within hearing, just so now did some string in him respond, and with animation. Which animation, by the way, might seem more or less out of character in the man in gray, considering his unsprightly manner when first introduced, had he not already, in certain after colloquies, given proof, in some degree, of the fact, that, with certain natures, a soberly continent air at times, so far from arguing emptiness of stuff, is good proof it is there, and plenty of it, because unwasted, and may be used the more effectively, too, when opportunity offers. What now follows on the part of the man in gray will still further exemplify, perhaps somewhat strikingly, the truth, or what appears to be such, of this remark. "Sir," said he eagerly, "I am before you. A project, not dissimilar to yours, was by me thrown out at the World's Fair in London." "World's Fair? You there? Pray how was that?" "First, let me." "Nay, but first tell me what took you to the fair?"
I went to exhibit an invalid ZZ chair I had invented.
Then you have not always been in the charity business?
Is it not charity to ease human suffering?
I am, and always have been, as I always will be, I trust, in the charity business, as you call it, but charity is not like a pin, one to make the head, and the other the point. Charity is a work to which a good workman may be competent in all its branches. I invented my protean easy chair in odd intervals stolen from meals and sleep.
You call it the protean easy chair, pray describe it.
My protean easy chair is a chair so all over bejointed, behinged, and bepadded, every way so elastic, springy, and docile to the airiest touch, that in some one of its endlessly changeable accommodations of back, seat, footboard, and arms, the most restless body, the body most racked, nay, I had almost added the most tormented conscience must, somehow and somewhere, find rest. Believing that I owed it to suffering humanity to make known such a chair to the utmost, I scraped together my little means and off to the world's fair with it.
You did right. But your scheme, how did you come to hit upon that?
I was going to tell you. After seeing my invention duly catalogued and placed, I gave myself up to pondering the scene about me. As I dwelt upon that shining pageant of arts, and moving concourse of nations, and reflected that here was the pride of the world glorying in a glass house, a sense of the fragility of worldly grandeur profoundly impressed me. And I said to myself, I will see if this occasion of vanity cannot supply a hint toward a better profit than was designed. Let some worldwide good to the worldwide cause be now done. In short, inspired by the scene, on the fourth day I issued at the World's Fair my prospectus of the world's charity.
Quite a thought. But, pray explain it.
The world's charity is to be a society whose members shall comprise deputies from every charity and mission extant, the one object of the society to be the methodization of the world's benevolence, to which end, the present system of voluntary and promiscuous contribution to be done away, and the society to be empowered by the various governments to levy, annually, one grand benevolence tax upon all mankind, as in Augustus Caesar's time, the whole world to come up to be taxed, a tax which, for the scheme of it, should be something like the income tax in England, a tax, also, as before hinted, to be a consolidation tax of all possible benevolence taxes, as in America here, the state tax, and the county tax, and the town tax, and the poll tax, are by the assessors rolled into one. This tax, according to my tables, calculated with care, would result in the yearly raising of a fund little short of 800 millions, this fund to be annually applied to such objects, and in such modes, as the various charities and missions, in general Congress represented, might decree, whereby, in 14 years, as I estimate, there would have been devoted to good works the sum of 11,200 millions, which would warrant the dissolution of the society, as that fund judiciously expended, not a pauper or heathen could remain the round world over.
11,200 millions. And all by passing round a hat, as it were.
Yes, I am no Fourier, the projector of an impossible scheme, but a philanthropist and a financier setting forth a philanthropy and a finance which are practicable.